Ελληνικά.
Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, December the 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump breaks protocol on China, but was it inexperience or intentional?
I think what's reasonable to say is there probably was some planning and discussion that went into this. This was a calculated move.
A UN summit tackles all the issues for a sustainable world. What to do about the potential for Trump's conflict of interests? Also ahead, movie reviews, including a Christmas classic.
You know, it just wouldn't be the holidays without It's a Wonderful Life.
All on today's International Edition. Donald Trump's team is downplaying the significance of President-elect's telephone conversation with the Taiwanese president, with which the U.S. has no formal diplomatic ties since 1979. Trump's tweet on Friday announcing a telephone conversation stoked questions as to whether he intends to alter America's longstanding acknowledgement of the One China policy that precludes any official recognition of Taiwan. Vice President-elect Mike Pence, weighing in on the controversy, did not dispute that Trump intends a more assertive U.S. posture toward China on trade and other matters. Let's talk more about this with Jamil Jaffer. He is the Director of Homeland and National Security Law at George Mason University School of Law. Thanks for being with us, Jamil. So how unprecedented was this?
An American president hasn't spoken with the leader of Taiwan in 1979. And so this is an unusual thing. It's something I think that folks in the Asia watching community did not expect. And certainly the Chinese government didn't expect it. And they've expressed their displeasure now in both a very public and apparently a private way. They've registered a protest with the U.S. And so the U.S. has for quite a while had what we call a one China policy, that is to recognize the government in Beijing. Since President Carter switched recognition from Taipei to Beijing in 1979. And that's been the U.S. policies for the better part of 25 years.
Is an introductory phone call really, why would that be a problem?
From people who think this is a problem, and I'd say that's a huge chunk of the sort of foreign policy community. I would, by the way, not put myself in that category. But for those folks, this represents a break with tradition or a break in our policy or a potential break in our policy, a policy that's been in place since, like I said, 1979. But, you know, from my perspective, actually, it's an aggressive move. And I actually think a very calculated move. I don't buy this. This is policy by Twitter. This was a random decision. He just took a phone call. I actually think this was a thought-out decision, at least one person. A think tank called the Project 249 Institute here in Washington, who's in the know and has apparently spoken to folks on this, has said this was weeks in the planning. And interestingly, you know, I mean, look, if the president of Taiwan just wanted to pick up the phone and call the president and see if he'd take a phone call, you would have thought that they would have made that phone call, you know, weeks or, you know, or months ago when the election happened. Instead, you've seen it in early December. And so I think what's reasonable to say is there probably was some planning and discussion that went into this. This was a calculated move.
Chinese state media said Trump's, quote, inexperience led him to accept the phone call, but they're warning that any kind of breach of the One China policy would destroy Sino-U.S. relations. A pretty outward statement there.
Well, I mean, look, the Chinese have long relied on the One China policy, but the U.S. has also long had, an informal relationship with Taiwan. They have a cultural mission here, functionally as like an embassy here in the United States. The United States has dealings with Taiwan, separate and distinct from China. And so there's always been sort of this formal one China policy. But, you know, truth be told, you know, we do have a relationship with Taiwan that is different from our relationship with Beijing. And Beijing has long known that, and we've long practiced that. Albeit outwardly and publicly, we say there's a one China policy. But look, the truth is that Taiwan is a very important player in world politics. And the U.S., I think, if the president decides to go down this road, could demonstrate its pushback on Chinese policy in the South China Sea by expanding its relationship with Taiwan. You don't need to throw the one China policy away for the U.S. president to take phone calls from Taipei and to be sort of more interactive with them. In fact, some might think that's a good response to the very aggressive Chinese posture in that region. But Taiwan has long been a U.S. Ally And, you know, until 1979, we recognized the Taipei government as the legitimate government of one China and the China that was previously led by the Taipei government.
So do you think the president-elect meant to jump into the fight between China and Taiwan?
In my view, this was a calculated move to say to China that we're not going to simply just accept your view of the world in that region, that the U.S. is, in fact, going to be a player in Asia. And our decision, even though the president has announced a decision to withdraw from the TPP, that doesn't mean we're not going to be players in Asia, and we're not going to let you push us around there. It's an area of strategic interest to us. The U.S. has long patrolled the Taiwan Strait, keeping the freedom of navigation open and not allowing the Chinese to simply close the strait off. And I think that this represents a pivot from the Obama administration's policy of, essentially, while they talked about a pivot to Asia, our friends and allies in Asia, I think, haven't really seen the benefit of that. And I think that this is a clear message to our allies in Asia and perhaps even our allies in Europe that the United States is going to have a different policy in this new administration than it has in the past.
All right. Jamil Jaffer, Director of Homeland and National Security Law Program at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. Well, President-elect Donald Trump has issued a warning to U.S. companies planning to move operations overseas. Don't do it. His words follow a visit by Donald Trump to an Indiana factory that was promised government incentives to keep jobs from going to Mexico. Now, to cover the story, VOA sent out two reporters, one to Santa Catarina, Mexico, and one to Indianapolis, Indiana. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti shows us what it's like for workers in both cities, beginning with Indianapolis.
Companies are not going to leave the United States anymore without consequences.
That's Donald Trump holding true to his campaign promise. At this stop, announcing tax breaks will keep 800 carrier corporation jobs from moving to Mexico. But the deal with his heating and air conditioning firm is just a first glimpse into Trump's plans. On Sunday, he sent a series of tweets threatening a 35% tariff on items made in offshore U.S. companies. In this exclusive VOA interview, the mayor of Santa Catarina, Mexico, invited Donald Trump to visit.
We invite him to get to know our people, the quality of our government, our infrastructure, and the foreign capital we have.
So far, there's been no response to the invite from the Trump team. Carrier's Mexico plant is located in a busy industrial city. The mayor says if one company shuts down, another steps in. People in the town praised Carrier's employee benefits, but requested we disguise their identity because they're forbidden to speak to the media.
It's the sporting.
Transportation, dining hall, scholarships, they help with your education. It's one of the best paying companies here.
Here in Indianapolis, Carrier isn't your typical American company. Inside the plant are generations and whole families of workers.
Me, myself, my mother, and I have a younger brother. I also have an uncle.
Five Cornette family members work at Carrier. Will was an early Trump supporter. This is his video of an April rally where Trump, an early candidate for president, called on him.
When they fire my two friends over there, raise your hand again.
Cornette says for now, his job will stay in Indianapolis.
He called us his good friend, and that's what friends do. They come through.
But for the 500 others, plus 700 losing their jobs at another Carrier plant, finding similar work in Indianapolis will be tough. Here they make an average of $23 an hour.
We can compete on every level, but it's hard to compete with $3 an hour wages they're paying to the folks in Mexico.
As for Trump, Union President Jones says it's about time someone spoke up for keeping American jobs in this country, but at what cost to taxpayers? In this first move of the Trump pre-administration, Carrier is getting $7 million in tax breaks for keeping half the jobs here. With Celia Mendoza in Santa Catarina, Mexico, I'm Carolyn Pursuti in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Russia and China block a 7-day ceasefire for Aleppo. A new IS spokesman takes aim at the West, Turkey, and Iran. Trump picks retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson as housing chief. And a new app is putting older eyes into focus. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, after months of protests and pleas from Native Americans and their supporters, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said Sunday that it won't grant an easement for the Dakota Access oil pipeline in southern North Dakota, handing a victory to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and its supporters, who argued the project would threaten a water source and cultural sites. The company constructing the pipeline, Dallas Energy-based Energy Transfer Partners, had said it was unwilling to reroute the project. Joining me now is University of Colorado Professor of Law Sarah Krakoff, whose expertise includes American Indian law and natural resources. Thanks for being with us. Explain what is at issue here.
Standing Rock was leading the way in the protest, but all the tribes would have been affected if anything happened to the Missouri, if there was a leak or a spill. And then the other issues were that the pipeline construction has gone across lands that were in our ancestral lands for the Sioux and the other tribes of the former Great Dakota Nation, and that the Energy Transfer Partners and Dakota Access Pipeline went ahead with the construction, even though the Corps, when they issued their temporary halt to the permitting process decision earlier, asked for voluntary cessation of construction of the pipeline.
It really did gain enormous traction with people across the United States, all over, showing support, including Senator Bernie Sanders, thousands of veterans that came to protest. Why do you think this resonated so much with so many people?
I meant to do something supportive of what they felt like.
Water is a big issue for people. They're realizing how this can be so detrimental. If it's clean drinking water, it's a life source.
It's true. Water is life. That's a saying in the San Luis Valley near me, where I live here in Colorado. Water is life. It resonates throughout many Native communities, too, and just makes intuitive sense to all of us.
If this was sovereign Native property, how was the government allowed to actually do what it had planned?
Two questions embedded in there. One is the status of the property where this final permit was put on hold, you know, most recently by the Army Corps, was denied until they could do a full EIS. So that's federal property owned by the Army Corps of Engineers. The land on which Energy Transfers went ahead and constructed their pipeline is today much of it private land, but it is the ancestral lands of the Sioux tribes that was reserved to them in a treaty in 1851. It's just that then the federal government sort of reneged on that promise, shrunk the boundaries first in 1868 and then a third time when they negotiated about all the individual tribes' reservations. So it's ancestral land. It's lands that the tribes have interest in and some rights to, but it's not within any tribe's current reservation boundary.
What specifically does this new decision by the Army Corps of Engineers mean?
It means that they are going to go back, the federal agency, and do a full environmental impact statement, which is a very lengthy and serious process that's supposed to produce a document with lots and lots of information about the environmental effects of this pipeline, not only this last section that would go under the rivers, but a full-blown EIS, as it's known, really should look at all the effects, including on species, endangered and threatened species in the area, on the cultural artifacts and burial grounds and sacred objects, and of course on the water quality. No pipeline is leak-proof. There just isn't such a thing. So hopefully they'll take all those impacts into account and then come up with a suite of alternatives.
That's University of Colorado Professor of Law Sarah Krakoff. Thank you so much for your time. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. As the holidays approach, there's a trend this time of year that can cause heartache to families here in the United States and abroad: child abductions by parents. Joining me now to talk about this is family law attorney Peter Walzer. Thank you so much for being with us. It's not something we hear a lot about, but so is this an issue that's more prevalent than people realize?
It is, because this is a key time for parents who live in different states or different cities to see their children over the holidays. It's standard practice for courts to order and people to agree on holiday visitation, and winter break is one of those times. Generally, winter break would be split between the two parents with the sharing of Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. But when a parent is out of state, this is one of the few times a year where they can see their child. So it's generally allocated to the parent who lives in a distant place.
This is a bigger problem around the holidays than it is in the rest of the year in the United States?
In the United States and throughout the world. I did a survey of other countries and see the same problem in Great Britain, in Canada, because of that fact that this is when the out-of-town parent will see the child, and perhaps it's when they have access to the child, and they may decide that they've been unfairly treated, or they may just feel the depression that people often feel around the holidays, where they feel lonely, they feel depressed, and then they start feeling that they've been deprived of their children, and they make a rash decision to not return the child. Often it's not a kidnapping where they'll go to the school and pick up the child, but they just won't return the child, or they'll disappear.
Is there one parent that's more likely to abduct a child, or is that usually the parent that doesn't have custody?
It's usually the parent that doesn't have custody, but it seems to be 50-50. The statistics show that both parents might be the one to abduct the child, although I think that generally the custodial parent is going to be the mother, and it would be the father visiting the child over the holidays, although a mother who doesn't have custody may be more likely to take the child than a father who doesn't. One indication that this is an international problem is that the Hague Convention on Child Abduction, Japan just became a signatory of this convention, and that was a big deal. But it even looks like Pakistan is considering becoming a signatory, which indicates throughout the world countries are signing onto this because it's such a big problem. But notoriously, there are countries like China, Russia, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, who are not signatories to the Hague Convention on the Abduction of Children. And it is a lot easier for a parent to get away with an abduction.
I would think this would be pretty traumatic, or have a pretty traumatic effect on the child.
But basically, this is a form of domestic violence. And it is traumatic on the child, traumatic on the family, traumatic on brothers and sisters possibly left behind, especially at a very young age where children don't have the ability to process their feelings, where they're going to remember this incident their entire lives, and it's going to be very damaging to them. And these are children that are already separated from their parents, so they're probably already traumatized to a certain degree. This is going to involve the police. I have been in situations where the police surround the home, the child is picked up by the police. So that kind of incident would be something a child would remember for their life.
All right. Family law attorney Peter Walzer, thank you for the information. Turning now to what's been trending on social media, we're joined by the lovely and talented G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori.
So Internet users chose Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi as the person of the year for 2016. What is that about?
Yep, so the Indian Prime Minister beat outgoing U.S. President Barack Obama, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, and WikiLeaks' Julian Assange to become the online reader's choice for the Time Person of the Year. As you know, the Person of the Year is the American magazine's annual issue that features and profiles a person, a group, an idea, or even an object that had the most influence in that particular year.
Wow. So I saw the magazine tweeted about it. Mm-hmm. What is the online reaction?
There is a lively discussion on the method used to select the online user's pick. And as the name suggests, the selection is based on the internet user's votes. One of the top replies to the Time magazine reads like this. India has a large population and the voting is not done through the Electoral College. The user named Kenneth added a winky face at the end of the tweet, suggesting that he won because of the large Indian population. Now, some Twitter users in India were not happy about that tweet and claimed China also has a large population and that those who questioned the online poll must be jealous. But of course, others pointed out American-born social media networks like Facebook and Twitter are blocked in China. But I want to add that you didn't need access to those social media sites to participate in this online poll.
So let's move on to another topic. The ride-sharing app Uber is in the hot seat again for some privacy concerns now this time, right?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of people are saying that its latest feature that allows the company to track the user's whereabouts even when they're not using the app is quite creepy. Tech-savvy Twitter users are reminding their followers to manually turn off tracking if they want privacy, but the overriding sentiment seems to be that it's just too much hassle to have to manually turn on and off the tracking before and after an Uber ride. Lori?
All right, G, thank you so much. You can follow her on Twitter at GAbbyLee and myself at Lori London. Well, lots of great new movies hitting U.S. theaters this week. Joining me now for What's Hot and What Is Not, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Hi, Jeff. Let's start with Nocturnal Animals, starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Amy Adams. How was that?
Nocturnal Animals has been doing really well in the film festival circuit. It won the Grand Jury Prize at the 2016 Venice International Film Festival. And this is from writer-director Tom Ford, whose background comes from fashion. He's not a filmmaker. He comes from the fashion world. But he's created this really neo-noir, haunting, romantic thriller that explores intimacy and tension, that explores the thin lines between love and cruelty and revenge, redemption. It's just got all this juicy stuff in it. And Academy Award nominees Amy Adams and Jake Gyllenhaal, they're a divorced couple who are discovering these really dark truths about each other and themselves. And what happens is her ex-husband, Jake Gyllenhaal, writes this novel called sends it to her before he publishes it. Said, I want you to be the first to read this. And it's just about this couple that's with their family who gets abducted and terrorized on a lonely, dark, rural country highway. And tragic things happen. And she's reading this book. And so the movie is about not only what's going on in her life, but also what's going on in the book. It's almost like, you know, you're seeing two movies at once. So the movie is just this web of neo-noir thriller that I just absolutely adored. And I think people are going to go crazy for the performances and also go crazy for the story.
Well, I know there's another one out for folks that aren't scared enough by the news and they want a little horror film.
Well, of course. It's Incarnate. And this is a take on the exorcism movie. Well, this time we got a different take on it, starring Aaron Eckhart, who's a doctor who believes that these manifestations, these demons, are parasites. It has nothing to do with religion, that they're these creatures that exist just to terrorize human beings. It's a combination of Exorcist and Inception. This time, a little boy, played by Dave Mazu, who plays Bruce Wayne on Gotham, and he's possessed. So he goes into his mind and fight the demons inside his brain. Because when they're possessed, the demons keep the real person like in a sleep state. So he's got to kind of wake them up. So I thought that was a really interesting take. It comes in an hour and 25 minutes. It's really short. It's really corny. It's getting really bad reviews. You know, it's not the greatest film in the world. But, you know, for teenagers, you know, it's rated PG-13. I think it's a great date movie. It's short and sweet.
Oh, yeah. Guys would love a good horror film to take someone on a date for. They'll be jumping in their laps with fear.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, we've got the Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life, that is approaching a milestone.
It is. It's coming out on DVD and Blu-ray this week, the 70th anniversary. And I had the pleasure of interviewing Jimmy Hawkins, who played little Tommy Bailey, one of the children in the movie. And this guy is an expert on It's a Wonderful Life. He's written five books. He goes around the country speaking about the film. He's done so much research on it. I had the honor of interviewing him, and it's on my YouTube channel on Vegas Film Critic, and we discuss not only the beautiful restoration of It's a Wonderful Life, but all kinds of trivia and all kinds of things, what this movie has meant to a lot of people. And, you know, it just wouldn't be the holidays without It's a Wonderful Life. He just gives some great stories and trivia that I had no idea about the movie, and I've seen that thing 50 times.
For anybody who may not know what the significance of the movie is?
Well, you know, It's a Wonderful Life was a bomb when it originally came out in 1946, and through the power of television and being in public domain, it's been replayed on television for the last 50 years, and it's about George Bailey, who wishes he wasn't born because things are going really bad in his life, and he's visited by an angel who shows him what his life would be like without being born. And of course, he did have a wonderful life, and he shows this to him, and he understands how blessed he is. And the movie takes you through this amazing journey. It's from Frank Capra, who just gave us Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and some of these films about the common man and about how hope always triumphs over tragedy.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard, we appreciate it. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's going to do it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Advancing the human rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex, or LGBTI persons, is a key part of the U.S. government's broader advocacy in supporting human rights and fundamental freedoms worldwide. U.S. President Barack Obama has committed to this effort during his administration, appointing the first-ever Special Envoy for the Human Rights of LGBTI Persons, Randy Barry, in 2015. Special Envoy Barry notes that the promotion of these rights internationally is based on the principles enshrined in the United States Constitution and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
All of our work in this field and in so many others in the human rights field at the State Department is really based on an understanding of what the promise of equal protection under the law and what equality really means under our Constitution. That really at the heart of what we're always talking about is not an issue of special rights for this community or any other, but really just an issue of equal rights absent any discrimination based on markers of identity.
Special Envoy Barry's work has focused on helping communities to help themselves by strengthening key global partnerships that promote the human rights of LGBTI persons around the world. One such partnership, the Equal Rights Coalition, was founded by Uruguay and the Netherlands and is now made up of 33 states, including the U.S. The coalition provides a standing platform for governments to consolidate efforts in achieving human rights and enables like-minded governments to more effectively cooperate, share best practices, and discuss common challenges. The U.S. also supports the Global Equality Fund, which joins more than 25 countries and private sector entities.
The Global Equality Fund, acting as a public-private partnership, has delivered in excess of $30 million in grants to civil society organizations in more than 50 countries around the world to really just get at the intersection of government and civil society and to just resource some very, very modest work of engagement, of visibility, of creative approaches to protecting the rights of this particular society.
The fund supports civil society actors such as the Sarajevo Open Center, an organization that is helping the Bosnian government and Bosnian civil society to work together to implement a national action plan on LGBTI inclusion. Special Envoy Barry said, "We're seeing what is truly an organic change at a global level."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.